With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey folks, Hannah here. I'm jumping into your feed before today's episode to let you know that I have a brand new YouTube show called Making Worlds. Monthly episodes are released on our Witch Please Productions Patreon, and they are an absolute hoot. Every episode, I am joined by a cool guest to talk about a sci-fi or fantasy text that has inspired them to move differently in the world and to imagine otherwise. Our first episode was about Our Flag Means Death, and our second episode is about Dimension 20. I am a huge nerd about both of those franchises, so as you can imagine, I had the time of my life. You can watch the episodes or listen to them as a podcast right now by becoming a Patreon supporter at patreon.com/awitchplease. You'll also get access to a backlog of many other perks. Again, head to patreon.com/awitchplease to become a supporter today for as little as $5 a month. Hello and welcome to Witch Please, a fortnightly podcast about the Harry Potter world. I'm Hannah McGregor.
And I'm Marcel Cosman. And as is customary, we shall begin this episode with the sorting chat. Hannah, I'm sorry. You know I hate to break the fourth wall, but that's not a very interesting or exciting introduction to this segment.
Yeah, I know that's true, but have you considered as a counterpoint that I am extremely tired?
I had not considered that. Okay. Well, I tell you what. How's about we lean into some low-key energy and talk about some of our favorite ways to rest and relax?
Oh, Marcel, this is the energy that I need in my life so badly right now. I just came off a pretty bad back injury that I am definitely actively recovering from, definitely feeling a lot better, but I did spend about 48 hours just horizontal. Just lying down on a heating pad, just kind of like on muscle relaxants. So like in that in-between space between sleep and waking.
Yes.
Just doing my absolute favorite, like my top no thoughts, only vibes activity is listening to a podcast I've already listened to while playing Best Fiends. A game I find so addictive that I have to delete it off my phone unless the only plan I have is to play it for 12 hours.
Wow.
Yeah, these little free iPhone games are very bad for my brain. Like my brain is just like, yes, this, more, forever, now, this, do it. Do it again, now, keep doing it. Don't stop. You don't need to eat. Stop. No, more game. And so I have to be very selective, but this was a perfect environment in which to, you know, fight some slugs. That's what you do in Best Fiends. You fight slugs.
That sounds wonderful. I only wish for you that you had been required to do that for non-pain related reasons, you know?
Yeah, I hear you. And also, often injury or sickness is the only thing that can actually convince me to take a break. Don't worry, I'm talking about it with my therapist.
Good, I'm proud of you.
We're working on it. What about you, Marcel?
Well,
you have 1,000 children, so it must be hard to find time.
Sometimes it is. I just love being in bed so much. I just love it.
It's so good. It's so comfortable in here.
I know.
I'm recording from bed.
Oh, I'm jealous. It's truly my favorite place to be, but I have learned over the last year or so that when I spend a significant amount of time sitting in bed, I fuck up my lower back real bad.
Yeah. That's not, beds are not chairs, I guess, technically. Technically, beds are not chairs.
Technically.
I'm sorry. We watched Cats over the weekend, and so now my brain is sort of on a cat is not a dog is kind of the level of sophistication I'm currently capable of.
And say a cat is not a dog.
Cat is not a dog. A bed is not a chair.
So I'm having to like find other relaxing ways to be that don't involve sitting
bathtub?
In bed. They generally need to not involve long periods of sitting in a thing that is not designed to support my body.
Sex swing.
Sex swing?
Yeah, but just for you.
You have seen our house. Where do you think we would put a sex swing? Outside? Outside. In a tree. Outside.
Outside in a tree. Maybe just swing. Maybe, do you think we could get adult, what are those bouncy things called that you like put a baby
yoga
in
balls.
And then they bounce? They
oh,
bounce up and
jolly
down.
Jumpers.
Jolly jumpers. I should know about this. I literally talk about jolly jumpers in my book, absurdly.
Amazing.
Can we get adult jolly jumpers? I feel like that would be really good for spine.
Yeah, maybe.
I'm not convinced by my own argument.
I don't know.
Okay, so you have to find a way to relax upright.
Yeah. I should probably start doing yoga again. But the thing that I really like doing, the thing that is like my favorite no responsibilities kind of treat is I just really love going to see a movie and getting a big bag of popcorn. That's what I love.
Oh, Marcel, I want to go see a movie so bad.
I know, me too.
I want to see the new Jurassic World movie. That's my new favorite way to rest and relax is specifically going to see the new Jurassic World movie. And I'm going to go alone because it's very important to me to have the power to laugh as loudly as I want at all of the scenes where people get eaten by dinosaurs.
Well, that sounds to me like the perfect place to move to our next segment.
Yes, correct. This is the segment where we talk about Hermione Granger. It's called Granger Danger. Marcel, tell me about some of the things you noticed.
Okay. Well, I would say the main thing that I was thinking about on this reread is the way that Hermione functions largely as a plot device. I feel like in this book, more often than not, she plays the role of moving the plot forward or conveying information rather than like really being a character who helps solve the mystery, I guess.
That's so true. She's not like an actually central part of almost anything that happens.
No.
She's just always there to like provide information or
to chastise.
Like, oh, that's so interesting.
Yeah. So like we can think about how Ginny knows that Hermione made out with Victor Crumb and this information is what sets Ron off on his sexcapade with Lavender Brown. And we know that we'll have that teen sex romper stinger right there, coach.
Doo-doo. Yeah, right there, coach. Put it in there, coach.
And then we have Hermione who, like, Hermione's function in potions class is just to be bad at potions. Like, that's it. That's all she
does.
Just
to be worse at potions than Harry.
Yeah.
And mad at Harry for using the Half-Blood Princess book.
Yeah. She gets upset at Harry for giving Ron Felix Felicis ahead of the Quidditch match, which turns out that Harry does it on purpose so that Hermione will think that he did, which is like real shitty move, Harry. That was not chill. Like, he could have let her in on the, anyway, whatever. It doesn't matter. And I think the thing that like really stings, the one that I'm just mad about, is the fact that Hermione cannot help herself. She has to say, "I told you so," about who Eileen Prince is, or about who the Half-Blood Prince is. Even though
she was wrong.
She was wrong. She spends the whole book being like, it could be a girl. And Harry's like, it's not. I can tell. And then at the end, when after we know that it was Snape, she's like, it's just that I was kind of right, because Eileen Prince was Snape's mom. It's like, what the fuck, Hermione? This is neither the time nor the place to say I told you so to your best friend who just watched his mentor get murdered.
It's absolutely wild. It's absolutely wild. But you're right. She is particularly two-dimensional in this book, because she is just in a lot of ways sort of going through a set of like, now it's time for the Hermione reaction.
Yeah.
And she's going to nag you, or she's going to be mad at you, or she's going to tell you to follow the rules, or she's going to, like, she just does that over and over again. Like, she's really, you know, shrill.
But, like, not in a fun way?
Not in a fun way, no. but this sort of vibes in an interesting way with what really struck me in my read-through, which is how many little glimpses we get of the richness of Hermione's life beyond what Harry sees. And so I think there's this really interesting, like, I think what those two observations lead to is, again, that reminder of, like, insofar as these characters exist beyond the narrative limitations of Harry's perspective, there's lots of stuff happening off screen, so to speak. And the one that really sort of jumped out to me is when Harry and Ginny are talking, and Ginny says that Hermione told her to, like, just try dating other people so that she could be more herself around Harry and, like, stop being so freaked out whenever she was around him. And I was just like, oh, yeah, the two of them have a whole friendship, an entire relationship that we never see because, by definition, it doesn't happen in that way in front of Harry.
That's right. Yeah. I can't remember what book this happens in, but, like, the little glimpses we get of that throughout the series, you know, like Ginny curled up at the end of Hermione's bed like a cat. And you're just like, wait, we're going to just blow past that?
Normal
friend
stuff.
At no point
stuff.
Is Harry going to be like, you guys are close.
What's up with this? I mean, I think, you know, Harry's a teenage boy, so he's like, who knows what girls do? Be friends, play cats together. Nobody knows. It's impossible. It's impossible to tell.
Yeah, that's the theme of this book, right? So, oh, wait, no, sorry. No, that's the theme of book four. I'm confusing the two because I was reading book four with Elliot recently. And so much of that book is Harry being like, why do girls travel in packs? Why are they always giggling? Why do girls do this?
It's really funny because book four is the one where that's like said overtly, but it's still very much the case in this one that there's this, like, what do girls do and why? Is that, you know, like the scene where Hermione, you know, conjures those birds and then makes them attack Ron, which is iconic.
Wonderful.
Like,
yes.
The fact that in the depths of her anger, she does magic that is more sophisticated than what her classmates can possibly pull off, that she's just casually conjuring things just out of anger, is really beautiful to me. But, like, you know, that is presented as this kind of mysterious activity. Like, what could Hermione possibly be so mad about? I do think sometimes that, like, these books are on occasion a little clumsily written. And I think sometimes in the attempt to make the reader, like moments like that, right, where it's like Hermione is angry, Harry doesn't know why, that is a scene of dramatic irony where we, the reader, are supposed to understand something that the characters do not understand, right? That we are like meant to be like, Harry, you goof, obviously Hermione's in love with Ron. And Harry just does, like, I think we're supposed to see that.
Mm-hmm.
Much like we're supposed to see that Ginny has had a crush on Harry this whole time.
Right.
Even though Harry has no clue. It's just the problem. We only get her through his lens. And so it's always these, like, such profoundly limited views, really, of any of the women in the series, because they're always, all of these women are presented through the view of a teenage boy.
I know. A very, very silly teenage boy. What do we think about the fact that Hermione uses the Confundus charm to ding around Cormac McLeggan's brain parts during the Quidditch tryouts so that Ron can be the keeper? What do we think about that?
I love, one of my favorite sort of Hermione through lines in the series is the gradual process of Hermione becoming ungovernable.
Mm.
That she like starts off so attached to following rules. And by the end of the book, she's like, oh, actually, fuck the power. Fight the power. Fuck yeah. The police. Fight the power. Fuck the police. That's Hermione by the end of this series.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, we should all also strive to become ungovernable.
I agree. Perfect. And now it is time for the segment where Hannah talks about fashion, and the name of this segment is Luke Beak.
Thank you, Marcel, for that extremely accurate introduction.
You're welcome.
Today, I want to talk about purple velvet.
Yes.
Yeah. So tell me, when I say the words purple velvet, what are the associations that come to mind?
Oscar Wilde.
Amazing.
John Waters.
Uh-huh.
Extremely famous dandies.
Absolutely.
Luxurious, but in a kind of like luxurious in a very deliberately flashy way.
Yeah. Absolutely. Maybe even camp. Like purple velvet feels a little campy.
Let's have a kiki.
I want to have a kiki.
Lock the doors.
Right.
Let's have a kiki.
Oh, hell yes.
Yeah. So purple velvet, some shade of purple velvet actually appears twice in this book. And the people who wear it are Dumbledore and Slughorn.
Of course, it's Slughorn. Oh my gosh. Okay.
Now he's wearing maroon velvet. And I think, you know, we could have a fight over whether maroon is a shade of purple or not.
Or red. Is that the fight?
It's a purpley red. I think by definition, that's what maroon is, like a purpley browny red.
Yeah.
But I think in terms of the sort of sartorial history that I'm going to sketch, I think it could be considered to be purple. And then Dumbledore's is a flamboyantly cut suit of plum velvet. Plum's definitely a shade of purple. We can all agree.
I think you're totally onto something here. I think plum and maroon are in the same family of like shades of purple that are not violet. Like they're not blue purples. They're red purples.
They are red purples, but purples they remain.
Yes.
So, velvet plays a really interesting role in the, what I've...
Mm-hmm.
I hate past me. Velvet plays this really interesting role in the, like, sartorial vocabulary of the wizarding world.
Hannah. I love when you write scripts.
Yeah. So it's a really common fabric for furnishings and curtains. Like there's a lot of velvet curtains. People are constantly pulling back velvet curtains. Constantly. But when somebody is... Yeah, me too. It's one of my favorite hobbies. But when someone actually wears velvet, it's noteworthy. And it's like always specifically noted and it's in really sort of unique circumstances. In fact, from what I can tell, the only other reference to purple velvet in particular in the series is Ron's dress robes. The
also
ones that
maroon,
he hates so
right?
much. Yeah, which are also maroon.
Oh my God.
That are so it's so interesting that maroon velvet is the thing that gives him like gender panic. And then maroon velvet is the thing that Slughorn is wearing in the first scene where we meet him, where mm-hmm. he is in this room that Harry is like, this seems like the room of a woman.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So there's some interesting gendered dimensions, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
But gender is not quite the locus I want to talk about when it comes to the history of velvet and the history of purple and the history of purple velvet.
Okay.
So, mini history of velvet first. This comes from a history of Renaissance velvet textiles by Melinda Watt, who explains that velvet was a super luxurious, expensive fabric that was woven from silk. You weave it in this way, you use really fine silk threads, and you weave it in this way where you create a whole bunch of little loops sort of sticking up from the top of the fabric, and then you shear off the top edge, and then what you've got is this, you know, very... Okay, here, let me actually... I'm just going to read how she describes it. So she says, the term velvet describes fabric with a pile, so that, you know, like a pile, like a carpet has a pile, like a...
Mm-hmm. Like high pile carpet is really shaggy and low pile carpet is really flat.
Yes. Made of silk thread. The structure of this fabric is created by warps that are drawn up over rods or wires to make the loops. This is part of the weaving process, and the looped pile is integral to the structure of the fabric. As the weaving progresses, the rods are removed. The resulting loops may be cut to form dense pile or left uncut. As well as being very time-consuming, this technique requires a larger quantity of thread in the warp than flat textiles, right? Because you're not weaving flat, you're weaving up.
That's right.
And it's made of silk. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. So velvet, you know, the luxuriousness of velvet has a lot to do with resources. You know, that's a lot of silk and with the expert labor that it required to actually make it.
I have never appreciated how luxurious velvet is until this moment right now.
And, you know, most of the velvet that we would have access, that you and I would have access to, would be machine-made velvet made out of synthetic fibers.
Mm-hmm.
So that velvet is much, much cheaper because it's been automated and it's made out of cheap, synthetically produced fibers. But mm-hmm. like, you know, original velvet, incredibly hard to make.
Yeah.
So in addition to that, Renaissance velvet was very unlikely to be purple because if anything was harder to make than velvet, it was purple dye.
Get out of here. Oh my God. Tell me why.
So prior to the mid-19th century, when somebody came up with a new synthetic purple dye, the only way to dye fabric purple was by harvesting the mucus of a kind of snail that only lives in Lebanon.
What the hell?
Absolutely incredible. So according to Evan Andrews, writing for a piece for history.com. I know, I'm a professional researcher.
Listen, you know what? As long as you're citing your sources, you're doing your research.
So they write, quote, it took as many as 250,000 mollusks to yield just 1 ounce of usable dye.
No.
And a pound of purple wool cost more than most people earned in a year.
That is... so many snails for so little dye.
It's so many snails. So we've got this incredibly rare dye that very quickly comes to signify power and wealth
uh-huh.
and gradually comes to be a signal of royalty. So
yeah.
So in the Elizabethan era, there were these things called sumptuary laws that were about regulating consumption, basically, in order to legally enforce the differences between the aristocracy and the commoners.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Like, basically, they didn't want wealthy merchants to be able to dress up like they were aristocrats.
Gotcha.
So there were these things that you weren't allowed to wear if you weren't, you know, a member of the aristocracy. Or in the case of purple, I think you actually had to be, like, a member of the royal family. It was illegal for anybody else to wear purple.
That is so wild. I, like, probably most people couldn't afford it anyway, but the fact that they put it into law is...
Yeah. It's not that surprising that purple has come to be associated both with royalty on the one side, but also with rebellion on the other. Because, right? So, like, purple was a really prominent color. Like, it, you know, it was used by the suffragists. It was like really popular in the 60s and 70s as a sign of counterculture. You know, Jimi Hendrix wore a lot of purple. Prince wore a lot of purple. Like, it's associated with counterculture. Because insisting on the right to wear purple is like a fuck you to authority.
Wow. I love it so much.
And you know what else was banned by Elizabethan sumptuary laws?
Oh my God, what? Velvet?
Velvet.
Was it velvet?
Yeah. Yeah. So obviously, you know, the significance of purple velvet, it's no longer illegal for you to wear it if you're not a member of the royal family.
Thank goodness.
Yeah, yeah. But those dual associations of wealth and power on the one hand and the defiant refusal of hierarchies on the other hand, I think still remains, right? So purple velvet both feels like a thing that you wear when you are dressing up like a king, but also a thing that you wear when you are like defiantly, you know, using fashion as a way to like defiantly declare yourself as being against the norm.
That's right. Yeah.
And that, I think, that duality is really captured by the fact that Slughorn and Dumbledore are both pictured as wearing this fabric.
That's right. Because Slughorn loves power and Dumbledore has absolutely zero respect for hierarchies like the Ministry of Magic. Wow.
Isn't that a fun history?
That is so fun. You know, things like this come up every now and again. And like by every now and again, I guess I mean literally every time we do Luke Book. And it gets me thinking like, wow, did Rowling know this? Or is it just such an unconscious part of our culture?
Yeah. I think it is an unconscious part of our culture. I think, you know, in the sense that signs, in the structuralist sense, gain this whole set of meanings that sort of attach around them that are like densely culturally specific. And we use those signs to allude to those larger cultural meanings, often without awareness of how they accrued to those cultural meanings in the first place.
Yeah.
Which is part of why it's so hard to read historical texts accurately, because we often have no sense of the sort of cultural meanings attached around particular signs.
Yeah. Okay. That makes sense. So like the relationship of purple velvet to power and refusal of hierarchies, similar to the function of the goblins as the moneylenders of the wizarding world.
Similar. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay, cool. Mm-hmm. Good.
Amazing. That's been Lookbook. Lookbook.
Thanks, Hannah. Wow.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey folks, Hannah here. I'm jumping into your feed before today's episode to let you know that I have a brand new YouTube show called Making Worlds. Monthly episodes are released on our Witch Please Productions Patreon, and they are an absolute hoot. Every episode, I am joined by a cool guest to talk about a sci-fi or fantasy text that has inspired them to move differently in the world and to imagine otherwise. Our first episode was about Our Flag Means Death, And our second episode is about Dimension 20. I am a huge nerd about both of those franchises, so as you can imagine, I had the time of my life. You can watch the episodes or listen to them as a podcast right now by becoming a Patreon supporter at patreon.com/awitchplease. You'll also get access to a backlog of many other perks. Again, head to patreon.com/awitchplease to become a supporter today for as little as $5 a month.
It is time for the next segment, Orchideus. This is the one where we each note something that we noticed and we're delighted by in this read-through. And Marcel, I want you to go first.
I think that often when we do Orchideus, I'm kind of struggling to think of things that I've noticed for the first time or things that like delighted me that I haven't talked about before because I've read the book so many times. But I actually have, I think, a real good one for the for this segment. And I will say that on this read-through, I feel like the book is a lot more sentimental than I ever noticed before. Like, there are a lot of ends to things, right? So some examples, not only has Aragog died, but now because Aragog is dead, you can't go into the forest anymore. The Forbidden Forest is truly forbidden now.
And it's full of all of these, like, the things that are in the Forbidden Forest that now they can never visit again are a lot of signifiers of their early adventures.
That's
like
right.
Like the feral car.
Yeah.
Like you can never go back.
No.
Quite literally.
Hagrid's hut gets burned to the ground. And, you know, like you were saying, Hannah, Hagrid's hut is this, it has been this
safe haven.
It's been a safe haven. This place of like regrouping, figuring out what they're going to do next. Harry got to be, he finally got to be Quidditch captain, but he didn't even get to play the last game. Like, that's it, you know, because he like tried to murder Draco. And I also realized that Harry gets really sentimental about Neville and Luna. Like, even from the beginning of the book, he like feels very tenderly about them because they're the only two who came to the ministry. And then they're the only two who show up at the end when Hermione calls the DA for help.
Which Harry thinks is because they're so lonely that they've just been watching their coins more.
Yeah.
I think they're just very loyal.
I agree.
Yeah, this book is in so many ways the like, childhood is over. You are past the point of no return. Like, things are happening that you can never go back to. And they will not be able to return to this version of Hogwarts that existed previously for them. And all of these, you know, like Dumbledore's death being the big one. But there's so many other moments like this that even though we don't really know yet by the end of this book that our main three heroes are not returning to Hogwarts, like everything points in that direction. That like they are not coming back. This period of their lives is over. And The piece that I pulled out is thematically very, very similar, which is that I was really struck on this read through by this. There's this moment right after Harry and Ginny have gotten together and just before the day when Harry and Dumbledore go to the cave and then Hogwarts is attacked. It's like they get this tiny sliver of time where they just get to be together. And there's this scene where the four of them are all hanging out in the Gryffindor common room. And Ginny makes this joke about, like, what kind of tattoo Harry has on him. The hippogriff tattoo. And she's like, no, I said it was like a Hungarian horntail because that's more hardcore. And it's just this moment where you get to see the four of them being kids together. And it just made me feel so heartsick for them all. Just like, these are just kids. And they are being forced into adulthood so rapidly. And the way that he gets, you know, this little moment and then almost immediately is like, nope, I can't do this. Like, I can't have the things that other kids can have because my life is too dangerous for that. And like, I kind of, that's a narrative device that I often find deeply frustrating. I think the first time I ever noticed it was as a child watching the Adventures of Lois and Clark.
Ooh, I watched that.
Remember the series,
yeah,
the
Dean
Terry Hatcher
and Dean Terry Hatcher.
Yep. And there's a scene where he breaks up with her because it's too dangerous for her to be with him. Mm-hmm. I just remember being like, that's stupid. I don't like that. But in this case, I'm like, yeah, I get it.
Yeah, it's so funny. You know, like on the one hand, so I agree. I think that it would be unsustainable to be in a relationship with somebody who has to go and personally murder the most powerful evil wizard who's ever lived. Like that just, it feels like it would be hard. He won't have enough time to, like, you know, support her in the way that a partner should be able to support her.
And she's very likely to be murdered as a direct result of affiliation with him.
But here's the thing. It's not like the Weasleys were secretly close to Harry. Everybody knows that the Weasleys are very close to Harry. Like, and what do they think, that like Percy is going to be closer to Harry than any of the others? Probably not. Like, she's already in danger. And so I think I agree that they can't make the relationship work in this horrible context. But I also wish that the rationale was more like,
I don't want us to try long distance right now, and I'm going to be on a quest.
I'm not ready for a long distance relationship when communication will be spotty.
I also wonder if he's lying to her because he's pretty sure that he's going to go die.
That's true. Oh, that's very true.
Anyway, it's a real end of childhood, end of innocence, you can never go back kind of book. And that's probably why all of our episodes about it have been so cheerful. Yeah, you could almost say that this book is devastating.
Ooh, what a fun transition. I call this segment Devastating Fun Facts, and what I do in it is I share some fun facts about Hogwarts students and staff not mentioned in the books because these things were not part of Harry's journey, and then I make you cry.
Me specifically.
That's right. Let's get into it.
You asshole.
Fun fact. When Harry gets back to number 4 Privet Drive after Dumbledore's funeral, he begins sorting through all his things so that, you know, he can keep and take with him only the essentials. During this process, Harry finds his old school photo from his second year at Hogwarts. Remember when Lockhart had started up the school pictures, and Harry had one that he wanted to give to Mrs. Figg, but then he didn't know how to give it to Mrs. Figg because he didn't know how to explain that it was moving. Anyway, he knows that she's a squib now. Anyway, so he decides to sneak it into her mailbox late at night with a little note, but he accidentally knocks over her mailbox. He knocks it off the hinges, and Arabella Figg comes to the door to see what's happening. She sees Harry, and she invites him in for a late night cup of tea and a piece of very stale cake. And the two sit together for a while, and Harry thanks her for always looking out for him, and he hands her his school picture. And Mrs. Figg stares at it, and she's speechless, and Harry explains why he didn't give it to her all those years ago, and then how he had forgotten about it until he found it earlier that evening. And then Mrs. Figg takes Harry's picture over to her fridge, and she pins it in place with a cat-shaped magnet. And then the two share a really long and wordless hug, and that hug says everything. You okay, Hannah?
I hate this segment.
I'm sorry. Fun fact. This is a poem that Hagrid wrote for his now deceased old friend Aragog. Long years make young old fighters, whether child or king of spiders. and the time has come I find you have left me on me own. Rest, old friend, your trials are over. Lay your burdens from your shoulders. For though the night's a little colder, I know I'm not alone. Are we good? Good? I've got more. Sorry, there's more.
Did I mention I hate this segment?
Okay. Fun fact. Understandably, young Tom Riddle left most of his personal belongings behind at the orphanage when he came of age. He felt no sentimental attachment to anything associated with the place, including this small box of papers that his mother had left behind with him. And these papers included like a tattered old map of London and a few ticket stubs, nothing that had any obvious value. But the box also contained a list of items that it appears Merope had been trying to gather in time for her baby's arrival. And so the list has things on it like marriage license, nappies, photo, blankie, and soft toy. And it's not clear whether Merope managed to acquire everything or anything on the list before her baby was born. But among the personal effects that Tom left behind at the orphanage was a very simple threadbare pale yellow blanket. Just one. Fun fact. This one's really fun.
Okay. Woo!
Horace Slughorn has a basset hound named Felicity. She's a very sweet old dog, and she spends most of her days sleeping. She loves to be close to Slughorn, so he keeps a dog bed under his desk and a very wide stepladder next to his bed so that she can get up and down easily. Do you want to know why her name is Felicity?
Yeah.
Because Slughorn found her the first time he took Felix Felicis. And even though the whole day was objectively perfect, it felt to him that it was specifically Felicity's companionship that made the day so good. You know, the thing about Felicity is she gives no indication that she's a magical dog at all. And we've established canonically that there are no magic dogs. But she is 32 years old, so she may be magical, right? Like, she may be more magical than she appears, at least.
Or, you know, he's devised some clever potions to extend the life of a dog because he loves her so much.
His companion. Fun fact, Bill's favorite color is purple.
What?
Fun fact, Fleur's favorite color is periwinkle, which Bill insists is purple, even though it's not. They bicker about it. It's very cute. Okay, last fun fact.
Okay.
Fun fact, for the duration of Draco's Imperius curse over Madame Rosmerta, visitors to the Three Broomsticks complained of various imperfections in her otherwise exceptional drinks. The draft butterbeer was a little bit flat, the fire whiskey was more like humid whiskey, and the gilly water was a touch salty. And now, a little fan service to all of our listeners with toddlers in their lives, I present to you Creature Report. Coach, activate Creature Report.
Creature Report. Creature Report. Creature Report.
Inheritance is such a farce. Check, check, check that Harry sends him to Hogwarts.
Check, check. Meow.
And forbidden to make a sound.
Creature Report, Creature Report.
He'll follow Draco all around.
Creature Report, Creature Report.
Well, Dobby shall be by his side.
Check, check, check.
Because Harry can't forget that one time Creature lied.
Dance break. Go house elf, go house elf, go house elf. Creature Report, Creature Report, Creature Report.
We're done with the fun facts. Which, please, at ease, until the next book wrap-up.
I'm so grateful that you started ending this segment with Creature Report, because it really helps to counteract the weeping.
I say fan service, but what I really mean is Hannah service.
Thank you. Thank you. Marcella, your skill for writing Hagrid poems... Like, it's just remarkable.
Who knew, right?
Who knew? Wow.
You know why? I think it's because I love a form. Give me a form. I'll play with it. It'll be fun. Thank Thank you, witches, for joining us for another episode of Witch Please. Witch Please is produced in partnership with Wilfrid Laurier University Press and distributed by Acast. You can find the rest of our episodes on our beautiful coach-designed website, owitchplease.ca. Special thanks, as always, to our team player of a producer, Hannah Rehack, a.k.a. Coach.
Thanks, Coach.
If you want to hang out with us some more, we're on Twitter and Instagram at owitchplease, with a ton of hot new content, thanks to our Witch Please apprentice, Zoe Mix. Thanks, Zoe.
Thanks, Zoe.
We also want to give a special shout out to our audio engineer, Erica Huang, who has been mixing our show since the reboot. Erica is moving on from Witch Please to continue their work on other shows and in other audio ventures, so we thought we'd take a moment to say thank you, Erica.
Thank you, Erica.
You made us sound so great for 6 seasons, and we appreciate you so much.
And we also appreciate everyone who supports us on Patreon. Thanks to you, we've now got seasons 5 and 6 of the reboot fully transcribed. I mean, thanks to you and Zoe who's doing the actual work.
Thanks, Zoe.
But you're funding it. So thank you also. And the rest is in progress. If you're not already a Patreon supporter, there's honestly never been a better time to jump in. We are constantly adding new bonuses. For example, we now have bloopers, comics based on those bloopers, and also Marcel names your pets.
Which is exactly what it sounds like.
Yeah. And exactly as good as it sounds. And we've got more exclusive live events in the future. TBA. If you want to learn more, head on over to patreon.com/owitchplease.
If you're not able to contribute financially, but you still want to lend us a hand, we would absolutely love it if you dropped us a review on Apple Podcasts. At the end of every episode, we'll shout out everyone who left us a 5-star review. So you've got to review us if you want to hear me spinning out waiting for you to pull me in. Thank you too. Save me some corn for later. Wow, that was a tough one to read. Creel Corazon, washing machine heart.
Yeah, it's a Mitski lyric. I'll send you the song.
Okay, line. I want it. Katie A2K14, horror cinephile. Everett H. Violet Wish. Wow, there's a lot of purple in this episode, just coincidentally. And ...
I think that reads ...
...
I know for a fact that this person devised that username specifically for the pleasure of hearing you say it, because they also tweeted at us to make sure.
... Incredible. You genius.
We are going to take a couple of weeks off our regular content to give us some time to read Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows, because these books is long.
So long.
But fear not, we will be dropping some very special bonus content into the feed in the meanwhile. But until then,
later, witches!